Well, good afternoon, everyone. So we're going to talk a little bit about the White Sox or Black Sox, depending on your proclivity here. So I was talking with my son earlier. I'm wearing my White Sox jersey, my shoeless Joe Jackson shirt, and my hat, of course. And he said, well, even if you don't know anything, you'll at least look the part. And I said, well, thanks for the confidence. So I want to talk a little bit about the White Sox, and for those of you who know what I do, not surprising there are going to be a lot of financial numbers here, because what I'm really interested in is asking the question, why would these guys who were so highly paid take this risk, and eventually they lost, of course, and I'm going to show you how much money they lost and, you know, what the return really was, but try and explain from a financial perspective. So I'm not going to get into the psychology of what went on, but from a financial perspective, what did this look like at the time, and why might these players have decided that this was a good risk to take? So first, just a real quick overview of what the sources I use. So the transaction card files, which are misnamed, they're actually the salary card files. That's where I got all of the salary information from. And then the financial information, which is a lot harder to come by for the teams. There are some account books. The ones that I use most heavily are the Yankee ledgers because we have a long period of time for those, from 1914 to 1942. Not complete, but we have a lot of data there. So the Yankees are really the team I lean on for a lot of the things, the conjectures I make about teams, because we have so much information on them. And then if you want to know anything about the Black Sox scandal, this is the place I would start, with the Sabre publication here. There are a lot of books written about it, but this one touches on all of them, and I think it cites everything ever written anywhere and published anywhere about the Black Sox. So this is really the place that I would start, if for no other reason than it's great bibliography. And, of course, Baseball Reference for anything that you see on here with attendance or performance I got from Baseball Reference. So just to tell you a little bit about the salary data that I have here, this just is for 1919. So the transaction cards do not cover every single player. There are some that are missing. And it just is a way to try and show you how much of the salary I do have for 1919 and for many other years. I just measured it by total plate appearances. So there's the payroll that I've calculated for each team. The payroll, the plate appearances in database, that column, that's the total plate appearances for all of the players for which I have salaries. And then the total plate appearances taken from Baseball Reference for that year. And so you'll see that the salaried players I have cover, for most teams, anywhere from 75 to 96-97% of all the plate appearances. In other words, they're pretty exhaustive here. So even the only three teams that are below that threshold, like Washington and Philadelphia and Detroit, the players that are missing aren't any big players. In fact, none of the starting players or the players who played most of the games are missing. It's a number of smaller players who might have appeared, you know, a handful of times. So the financial details here for these payrolls are pretty good. As I find more records, they do change. My numbers will change, but that's not going to change the overall payroll here. As you can see, the White Sox here, and I'll show in a minute, the White Sox had the highest paid payroll. There are not enough players left on any other team to actually, for any team to overcome that. So I'm very confident in my numbers here on what the White Sox have done. So let me jump right to the point here. This is how much money, the far right column is the amount of money that I estimate, I think very conservatively, that each of the eight players lost by playing this. And I do this with just making a couple of assumptions. My first assumption is they would have won the World Series had they not tried to lose the World Series. I'm going to take that. In which case, they all would have made another $2,000, essentially. And then I made a fairly conservative estimate that if they hadn't tried to throw the World Series, they all would have continued to play, and I just estimated they would never have gotten paid any more than they did in 1919, which is really conservative because they all got raises for 1920, and they played in 1920. And then I assumed that they would all play either until age 32 or for two more years after 1920, because they all, except for Eddie Seacoat, Chick Gandel, who retired, they all played in 1920. So I project, you know, fairly short careers for most of them, making not a whole lot more money than they did in 1919. And yet the case is still, if you look at the far right column and you compare it to the column labeled bribe received, in which case what I did was, you know, biasing the other way, I assume that the most generous amount of money that I ever saw in any of the, you know, substantiated reports in the research about how much money they got. I assumed that's what they actually got. So when Eddie Seacoat, in an interview, you know, more than once, said he received $10,000, I assumed, okay, let's say he did. He got the $10,000, and it wasn't anything less than that. The only person here who actually comes out ahead, and only if the stories about Chick Gandel absconding with most of the money are true, would be Chick Gandel. Now, I'm not pretending that I know whether they received these amounts of money. I'm just using those as comparisons to show that the decision in 1919 for them to throw the World Series really backfired. I mean, obviously, they all lost their jobs. They were all humiliated. None of them were convicted, of course, but they never played baseball and organized baseball again. And again, the financial decision doesn't seem to add up, right? So let's take a little, you know, little bit of time here to ask this question. Why would you think about doing this, given the fact that you're paid pretty well, and you're all pretty young? Only Eddie Seacoat is really that old, and it's a pretty decent living here. It seems like it would be easy money, though, if you don't get caught and if you get paid. Remember, what we're talking about here is thieves consorting with cheaters, and then you can't really wonder why somebody didn't do what they said they were going to do here. Now, the other thing we want to keep in mind is that gambling was widespread. It had been going on for a long time. The players were always in contact with gamblers. This was not at all unusual. If we drew a Venn diagram of players and gamblers, there'd be a lot of intersect here. And furthermore, over history, it was rare for a player to get expelled for a lifetime for gambling. In fact, nobody had been kicked out of baseball for gambling for 40 years. It hadn't been since 1881 that anyone was actually thrown out of baseball because of gambling. And there are lots of stories about players betting on teams, betting on themselves, stories about people who tried to lose games, a lot of stories about teams who rewarded other teams for winning games or losing games. So there's a lot of evidence out there that gambling was, you know, if not pervasive, certainly widespread. And so it might not have been as obvious to the players at the time that, A, they were going to get caught, and B, if they did, that they were going to be very severely punished, because there just wasn't a recent track record of that happening. So, why do they do it then? Well, it couldn't be because the money was so easy that it was a no-brainer, because if that was the case, there would have been a lot more brazen attempts, one would think. We would hear more about teams trying to throw a World Series or something. So it can't quite be that simple that this, you know, gambling was such easy money that we'll do it all the time. So instead, we lean on the other explanation that we have, that it was disgruntled players. Now, the standard explanation that has been debunked by researchers way before me is that Charlie Comiskey was just cheap. Well, Charlie Comiskey was no cheaper than any other owner, and in fact, as we know, he was actually more generous than the other owners. So it wasn't that, but it does lead to some testable questions here. So there are four questions that I'm going to ask here, and I'll run through these, all with financial data, to ask a couple things. Well, first of all, did the players earn a decent wage? I mean, did they need to gamble? Did they need to throw games in order to put bread on the table? How did their salaries compare to other baseball players? So I want to look at the White Sox in particular and say, well, you know, were they paid as well as their competitors? Or were they maybe jealous of all of the other players? How were they paid relative to the revenue they were generating for Charlie Comiskey? So this is where it might really be relevant that Charlie Comiskey was cheap. If he was taking money that the players were generating for him and keeping it for himself. Now, I'm going to show that he was doing that, but so was every other owner. So that isn't the case. And then the last one that I'm going to come to is, how were the Black Sox players, the eight players who got thrown out, how did their salaries and their performance compare to the other players? And to me, this is really going to be kind of the crux of the argument right here. So let's start with asking whether they earned a decent wage. And the answer to that is already known, and it's one word, duh. Very, very well, okay? So these were the salaries they were making. Throughout this presentation, all the red names are always the eight players who were eventually banned for life. So here are the salaries that they earned in 1919, okay? So how does that compare then to the average guy? All right. Well, let's take a quick look here. The average Major League Baseball check in 1919 was $3,285. Several of the White Sox were making more than that, some substantially. The highest paid player was Ty Cobb. Second highest paid player in the major leagues in 1919 was actually Eddie Collins. How did that compare to what economists call an opportunity cost? In other words, if these guys weren't playing baseball, what would they be doing? Well, for most of them, they would be probably working on an industrial site somewhere, maybe on an assembly line, because most of them weren't Eddie Collins. They didn't have college degrees. They would have been working, 40-hour weeks at, manufacturing wages. Well, the average U.S. manufacturing wage in 1990 was $860 per year, okay? So the average major league player is already making four times that amount. So the salary they're making is pretty good, as long as you're white, okay? So the black professional players are not paid nearly as well. So I have data from the nearest year to 1919 was my 1918 Hilldale data, and the average wage for a Hilldale player that year was $304 for the season, and the highest paid player on the team was Louis Santop, who made $730 that year. Now, Louis Santop, of course, probably couldn't have made $860 working in industrial work because a lot of that was segregated. But going on, how does that stack up then to some of the other regular guys? Well, in the business of entertainment, baseball players weren't the highest paid. In fact, the highest paid entertainer in 1919 was a movie star named Mary Pickford, who earned $10,000 each week. All right, so maybe they were jealous of Mary Pickford, but throwing the World Series wouldn't have been as efficient as moving to Hollywood and making a movie. So as we said, the White Sox players compared across the league, their salaries were very good. The White Sox had the highest payroll, and the White Sox were paid very well. In fact, the White Sox didn't just have the highest payroll in 1919. They also had the highest payroll in 1918, the third highest payroll in 1917. They were in the top half of Major League Baseball up until 1922, after they all the players were gone. So Comiskey has a history of paying his players very well. So it's not that they don't get paid well relative to other players that could really be the objective that they're, problem that they're having here. So let's take a look at the average White Sox salary. So if we just compare the average White Sox player to the average Major League Baseball player, that ratio from 1915 up until 1922, the White Sox were always paid on average better than other players, all right? So they're making 118% to 103% of what the rest of the average baseball players are making until 1922, when they finally fall below the average. So they're paid very well. They're paid very well relative to the other players. But let's look at the top end and see if this is where some of the problem is. So baseball's biggest paychecks in 1919, these are the top 10 or 11 paid players. Only Eddie Collins is up there. And now Eddie Collins stands out among the White Sox because not only is Eddie Collins paid more than twice as much as any other White Sox player until 1920, he also has one of the rarest contracts in baseball at this time, which is not just a multi-year contract, but he signed a five-year contract which guaranteed his salary of $15,000 a year. So he never got a raise from Comiskey, but he had five straight years of a multi-year contract, which was almost unheard of in baseball at the time. Now, if we take a look at the highest paid players, which is probably what the Yankees would have done if they'd had the chance, this would have been the lineup right here, and the only one of those players, the highest paid player at his position, was Eddie Collins. No other White Sox player was among the top three, all right? So this isn't the $100,000 infield, but it's a $98,547 lineup you could have put on. This is the highest paid at each position. Now, with all of these numbers, let me just take 1 second to put that into perspective, okay? What would $98,584 buy today? Well, it would buy you one batter faced this year by Max Scherzer, or one pitch faced this year by Jason Hayward, okay? So that's what that money would get you today. Now, if we take a look at pay by position, here we get to a little bit of a hint as to maybe why these eight White Sox were disgruntled. You see that Eddie Seacote and Lefty Williams, who had really, really good years in 1919, they were 18th and 61st highest paid players in baseball. Chick Gandel was number 11 out of 16 starting first basemen. Buck Weaver was number 4. McMullen was 11. Swede Risberg was the 12th highest paid shortstop. Shoeless Joe Jackson was the third highest paid left fielder, the seventh highest paid outfielder, and Happy Felch was the 11th highest paid outfielder. So relative to the top players in the game, the White Sox don't look as comfortable. So those average salaries can be a little misleading because it's pulled up a lot, you know, by Eddie Collins' $15,000, which was, again, by far the highest salary. Now, one of the better questions, though, is what do you get for that salary, okay? So just a simple comparison is what does it cost to get WAR, all right? So we'll just use, I'll just use WAR as a measure of productivity here. Now, I will, you know, grant right away that they weren't using WAR back then, okay? The only WAR they were talking about was the one that had just ended and cost them salaries. But it's still a good round measure of the productivity of a player. So it's a decent way to say, hey, how good were these guys? What were they getting paid for? So these are the same. This is that same list of the top 10 highest paid players in baseball. Ty Cobb was, you know, generated 5.5 WAR. So each one of those WAR cost his team $3,600. Eddie Collins $2,900. You go down. The guys you really want on your team were Babe Ruth and Walter Johnson because they were cheap WAR. Now, what does that mean, though? I mean, you know, was Eddie Collins overpaid, underpaid? You know, what does that mean that the team was paying $3,000 to Eddie Collins for each WAR he generated? Well, let's take a look at a slightly different way of looking at this, which is baseball players are hired by their teams, much as us fans don't want to admit it, not to play baseball, but to generate revenue for the owner, all right? So there's another economic term that we can measure called marginal revenue product. And I'm not going to bore you with the math behind that. I'm going to show you a graph which compares marginal revenue product, which is the amount of revenue that a player generates. And you can think about it as if wins attract fans and money for the team, how many wins does this player help me get and how much money is that worth? And in a competitive market, a player should be paid very close to exactly as much money as he generates. So let's take a look here. The blue line is the revenue that the average player in Major League Baseball generated from 1914 to 1928. And the orange line is the salary on average that they generated. So as you can see, it doesn't matter how much an owner is paying for WAR. On most cases, they're getting a lot more money than that. In other words, the players are drastically exploited by the owners, which was the case up until the mid-1970s when free agency debuted, because there was no other way for the players to earn this kind of money. Now, that's a completely separate discussion, so I'm not going to delve into that, except to say that the amount of money being paid for, you know, this price per WAR, the real number we want to look at isn't going to be how much they were paid, but how much that guy is making and how much I'm making. We're all being underpaid, but if I'm being underpaid by more, I'm probably not going to be too happy, okay? So let's just put some names to this. This is from a different study I did a few years ago on the New York Yankees. Here are some numbers here. So these are the salaries of some Yankee players from 1919 to 22 and the estimated marginal revenue product, the amount of money they generated for their team, and then what we call an exploitation rate, this ratio of how much the owner is making for every dollar that they're paying the player. Remember, in a competitive market, this should be pretty close to one. So we see, for example, that Ping Bodie was making $3,600, about six times the, you know, or five times the average annual wage he could have been making as a working stiff, was still only making about 10% of the money that he was generating for his team. And then, of course, in 1921, Babe Ruth looks like a real bargain, but he was being paid $52,000. He's generating more than four times most of these other players here. But if you were Bob Musial that same year, who had a really good year, and he generated about $83,000 in revenue for the team was making $20 on every dollar that they were paying him. So the players are being exploited. But now what we want to know is, were the Black Sox being exploited more than all of the other players, especially the ones they're more familiar with? And this is where we really want to take a look at what's going on in the team. So let's take a look at the White Sox salary dispersion here from 1915 to 1922. These were the eight straight years where Eddie Collins was the leader in team salary. And up until 1920, he made more than the next two players combined. It wasn't until 1920 when Eddie Seacott and Ray Schalk got raises to $10,000 that he finally didn't earn more than twice what anybody else owned. So, in fact, it was Eddie Collins, who was one of the players that, you know, a lot of the White Sox researchers will look and say, he didn't get along at all with these, you know, these Black Sox guys. They didn't like him. Well, let's take a look at why they might not have been too happy with him. So here are the White Sox starting players plus all of the eight, the players who played the most often. So, again, the red names are the Black Sox here. And if we take a look at just that far right column, that's how much money that they were earning for the contributions they were giving to the team. So if you take a look, that yellow line there, that's Eddie Collins. He's the highest paid player. He generated 5.1 WAR that year, but that wasn't the best on the team. In fact, the three best WAR for the team, or almost the three best WAR, Happy Felsch is pretty close, are the bottom three guys on this list. So when you look at the regular players on the White Sox, it's Jackson, Felsch, and Seacoat, who are three of the four most productive players, and their salaries are pretty good salaries, but relative to what Eddie Collins is making, or, you know, what Murphy and Shane O'Connor, I mean, Shane O'Collins could have been replaced by, you know, any average replacement guy, and yet he was being paid $4,200. Down here, you got Eddie Seacoat, who generated almost 12 wins for the team, and he's being paid $424 for each one of those. So this is certainly an area of contention. Now, this was 1917, so this is 2 years before, but it doesn't get a lot better in 1918. In 1918, in fact, you know, Seacoat and Williams are at the very bottom, making a lot less for what they do. So to me, this suggests a potential problem that the White Sox may have had, is the salaries were really high, but they weren't well distributed within the team. They were not distributed based on the productivity of the players, certainly not from the perspective of certain of these players. You notice, for example, that six of these eight players who got expelled for taking money from gamblers were all paid at a lower rate than Eddie Collins for paying, you know, for playing baseball. Some were as productive or more productive than Collins, but they were all making far less than Eddie Collins. Now, I don't mean to pick on Eddie Collins. It wasn't his fault that Comiskey promised him all this money. But I'm suggesting that Comiskey may have sown the seeds for his own team's demise here in the way that he rewarded his players and didn't reward his players based on that. Now, I've already shown you that it turned out to be a very bad deal for the players to take this, you know, take these bets. But what happened to the White Sox, all right? So what happened to the White Sox over the next 10 years after their team was torn apart after the 1920 season? Well, to do that, I want to take a look at the Yankees here. And since we don't have good financial records for any teams other than the Yankees, what we need to do is be able to kind of approximate what the player or what the team would have done here. So if we take a look here, just ignore the bottom few numbers here because that's after Yankee Stadium was built and became a huge money generator for the Yankees. The number one source of revenue for these teams was attendance and items tied to attendance like, you know, selling hot dogs and wieners and beer at the ballpark. So home receipts were between 60 and 75% of Yankee revenues until Yankee Stadium was built. Then it's not like their attendance went down. It's that Yankee Stadium revenue went up. So attendance is a really good measure of the financial, you know, performance of a team here. So let's take a look at what happened to White Sox attendance. Well, not surprisingly, it went down after 1920, but so did the average Major League attendance. Okay, so if we take a look at the White Sox relative to Major League Baseball, up until 1927, they were always above average in total attendance. So even though their attendance fell, and it fell by a lot relative to the league, they were still in the top half of the league. Now, if we take a look at the Sox payroll actually kept going up, but that's because baseball payrolls went up, and also 1919 was, you know, uncharacteristically low because the season was short and the number of players per team was also reduced. But if we take a look at the ratio of the Sox to Major League Baseball's payroll, you see that in 1919 they were paid 39% more than the average team. That fell, but they still pretty much stayed above average or right close to it this whole time, okay? Now, if we then take this measure and divide attendance by payroll, we get these numbers which have the following meaning. If you look at the White Sox column, in 1919, the White Sox sold 6.36 tickets for every dollar they paid their players, okay? So if we take a look at those numbers, we see that, you know, after 1920, they really fall off. But again, if we compare them to Major League Baseball's average, we see the White Sox were pretty much always above the average in terms of how many tickets they're selling for dollar of payroll. And payroll is the biggest expense for the team. Now, the research that we have that, you know, other people have done and my co-author David Serdam and I have done before shows that teams in the 1920s and the 1930s, on average, were making money. Okay, very few teams were actually losing money in the 1920s and 30s. So the average team was making money. If the average team is making money and the White Sox are, you know, performing better than the average team, the White Sox are probably making money. So my suggestion here is that the players came out far worse in this than the White Sox did. The White Sox may have taken a hit, but Charlie Comiskey was not on any bread lines after the White Sox were banned. So the conclusion then, if you were a white ball player, you shouldn't have tried to throw the World Series because you were making too much money and it wasn't going to pay off if you got caught, okay? And the White Sox especially were well paid relative to everybody else. But the problem was the way those salaries were distributed did sow some seeds of dissension among the team. And given the circumstances that were surrounding that, I think it was fertile ground for these players to say, this is easy money, and this is how I can make up for what I should have been getting. Throwing the series hurt the players a lot more than the team. And looking back, it seems pretty obvious that this was a bad decision. In fact, through the rest of their lives, a lot of the players who were kicked out thought that it was a bad decision. And I will conclude with the statement that Happy Felsch gave to an interviewer near the end of his life when he was asked, why did you throw the games? What were you thinking? And his response was, I was dumb, all right. So thank you very much. Well, go to the Sabre publication book, and there's a great biography. And I think they're all up on the Sabre bio website, too. Most of these guys kind of faded into obscurity, and, you know, they took different jobs that you would expect a guy with a high school education and, you know, not many great skills to have. So, you know, none of them really shone brightly after that. So,
Mike, did the players know each other's salaries?
Probably. I'm going to guess that they talked about this, that they had an understanding. They certainly, you know, wouldn't have had the same kind of access that we have to salaries today, where they're published in the newspaper all the time. But the players hung around with each other all the time, so almost certainly there was talk, and they knew what each other were making. So it looks like we have another presentation here, so I'm going to have to get out of the way, but I'd be happy to chat with anyone afterwards. Thank you very much.